Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 10th, 2024. I'm your reader, Sharon Falgino, and from the front page of the today's Gazette, unusual coalition of foes forms against vaping bill. Proposal backed by tobacco companies would restrict sales of vaping products in Iowa, by Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. A bill supported by the tobacco industry that would ban retailers from selling vape products not listed on a state-approved registry has united two disparate groups in opposition, vape shops and public health advocates. The companion legislation, House Study Bill 682 and Senate File 2402, would require retailers, distributors, and wholesalers who sell vapor products in the state to put them on a new registry. Retailers could sell only products listed on the registry, which would be limited to those the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved for sale. The registration fee is $100 per product. Those that violate the provisions would be subject to a $300 a day penalty. Money collected from fees and penalties would be deposited into a trust fund to be used for substance use disorder treatment and prevention and tobacco prevention, cessation, and enforcement. At first blush, the bill seems to close a loophole leveraged by e-cigarette manufacturers and distributors. Before manufacturers can sell new e-cigarette products, they must submit an application to the FDA to market the products. The FDA then can either grant their application, at which point they can sell their products indefinitely, or the FDA can deny their application, at which point they must cease selling them altogether. But because of the lengthy time it takes the FDA to process applications, or because of legal challenges to denials, manufacturers and distributors keep their products in the marketplace until they receive a final answer. Since 2020, 26 million tobacco products, the vast majority of which are vapor products, have been submitted for FDA approval. To date, the FDA has authorized just 23 e-cigarette products and related devices, all of them tobacco-flavored, while rejecting more than a million applications. And only three brands, all made by tobacco companies, have received FDA marketing authorization. Manufacturers have challenged the denials in court and use a variety of legal maneuvers to delay agency action. As a result, thousands of e-cigarette products, including flavored products popular among youth, are being sold in Iowa and across the country without proper FDA authorization. The FDA has not aggressively pursued enforcement actions against manufacturers who either never applied for FDA approval or who did but persist in selling products that have not been approved. The tobacco industry-backed registry law, which mirrors those passed and being considered in other states, is purportedly intended to fill the enforcement void left by FDA inaction and inability to control the tumultuous vaping market more than 3 years after the agency declared a crackdown on youth-friendly flavors. Most of the unauthorized disposable vapes being sold in the United States, such as Elf Bar, come from China in sweet and fruity flavors that have made them a favorite nicotine product among teens. Hundreds of new varieties appear each month, the Associated Press reported. The influx has upended the FDA's regulatory model. Instead of carefully reviewing individual products that might help adult smokers, regulators must now somehow claw back thousands of illegal products sold under the radar. Public health advocates say lawmakers should carefully consider the public health implications of the bill and evaluate whose interests it advances. The American Cancer Society is registered opposed to the bill, as is CAFA, CAFE, or Clean Air for Everyone, Iowa Citizens Action Network, an organization that advocates for tobacco control. The American Heart Association and Iowa Primary Care Association are registered undecided. At the end of the day, this bill will do nothing to reduce youth consumption, nor adult use, likely, said Thrias Harms, a lobbyist for CAFE, Iowa Citizens Action Network. We see it as an industry bill that does nothing other than help tobacco companies increase their market share and ultimately their profits. If serious about reducing youth vaping, lawmakers could consider advertising bans, taxing vape products the same as tobacco products, and requiring a retail permit fee, Harms said. Corey Halfill, owner of Central Iowa Vapors, which has stores in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, said the bill would eliminate 99% of the vapor products on the market and force him to close his 15 stores, putting 80 workers out of a job. It would overregulate us to the point where you can't conduct business, Halfill said. We're not like a convenience store. You take a handful of items out at a convenience store, they're going to be able to continue to sell gas and be able to continue to sell soda, all of the snacks and things. He said the industry is frustrated by FDA inaction and is advocating for fair regulations that allow for vaping products to remain on the market while ensuring consumer safety. He said he regularly meets with manufacturers and visits their facilities, including in China, and requests documentation that their products have either been approved, denied, or pending review by the FDA. Half Hill emphasized the importance of addressing youth vaping, but thinks the government should focus on holding social media giants accountable for promoting vaping products to minors and work with the industry to promote tobacco harm reduction and support products proven to be safer than tobacco. Half Hill and Sarah Linden, owner of Generation V in Council Bluffs and Davenport, said vape users will find other ways to get their product if it is unavailable in their stores, whether online or just across the border in neighboring states. If this bill goes into effect, businesses like mine, because we are good actors, will close, Linden said, but there's going to be stores that don't, and then they're going to be selling whatever illicit products to whatever age group, including potentially teens. David Scott, a lobbyist for tobacco giant Altria Group that's pushing the bill, said the measure prevents illegal products from overseas popular with youth. China has over 50% of the products that are illegal, Scott recently told a House Ways and Means subcommittee. Three out of the five youth brands are illicit, but they are still being brought in. Gregory Conley, Director of Legislative and External Affairs for the American Vapor Manufacturers, said the FDA uses U.S. Customs and Border Protection to stop illegal products before they enter the United States and conduct inspections and issue civil penalties to manufacturers and retailers of illegal products. The FDA, with their $712 million budget, has decided, oh yeah, we're just going to only target specific products that have youth use problems, he said. That's something you could do in this bill, but just saying all these products have to be banned, terrible, terrible policy. There's a reason why Barclays and Goldman Sachs and Altria investors are so interested in this policy. Both Barclays and Goldman Sachs have said that one way for Altria to recover their failing cigarette sales is to put people like Half Hill and Linden out of business. Conley said the bill imposes a confusing and complicated registration scheme that has been challenged in courts in other states. The FDA in 2016 deemed e-cigarettes to be tobacco products like traditional cigarettes, subject to agency review under the Tobacco Control Act, and said manufacturers of the products would need to apply for approval to continue selling them. It initially considered e-cigarettes as having some promise in helping adult smokers transition from conventional cigarettes, but faced pressure from anti-smoking groups to restrict flavored e-cigarettes amid a rise in youth vaping. What's next? The House and Senate bills were approved by subcommittees and will be heard by Ways and Means committees in their respective chambers. My big concern is public safety, making sure that these products that people are consuming is safe in the marketplace, said Representative John Forbes, Democrat Urbandale, who served on the House subcommittee. My other concern is, you know, passing legislation here that has an impact on businesses here in the state of Iowa. People are going to still vape regardless, but I'd hate to have us pass legislation that's going to affect jobs and, you know, viable, ongoing businesses that could be out of business or severely restricted in sales. Republicans signed off on the bills to continue the conversation. Turning to the Iowa Today and the week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. Under the heading In the News, Iowa GOP celebrates Trump ruling. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled last week that states do not have the authority to keep candidates off the ballot for violations of the 14th Amendment, overturning a Colorado court decision that sought to disqualify former President Donald Trump from the state's primary ballot over his role in the January 6, 2021 insurrection. The U.S. Supreme Court found that Congress has sole jurisdiction to enforce the 14th Amendment. Iowa Republicans applauded the ruling and said that attempts to remove Trump from the ballot were election interference. Reynolds endorses Trump. Republican Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds gave her official show of support to former President Donald Trump last week, even as the two butted heads throughout the Iowa caucus campaign. Nikki Haley dropped out of the race Wednesday, leaving Trump with no major opponents for the GOP nomination. Biden wins Democrats' mail-in caucus. Iowa Democrats overwhelmingly voted for President Joe Biden in their first ever mail-in caucus. The results of the contest, which Democrats were forced to change after they were kicked out of the first-in-the-nation spot by the National Party, were announced Tuesday. Biden won nearly 90% of the vote, while Marianne Williamson, Dean Phillips, and Uncommitted received between 2% and 4%. Lawmakers target immigration. Senate and House lawmakers passed bills adding restrictions on undocumented immigrants and allowing state officials to arrest immigrants without legal status. Republicans said the bills were needed to address a vast increase in illegal border crossings under President Joe Biden. One bill would make a migrant found in Iowa who has previously been deported guilty of a state violation. Another bill, which the House passed, would create a crime of human smuggling for someone who houses or transports an undocumented migrant for financial gain, with the intent to conceal them from police. Teacher pay boost passes. House lawmakers passed a bill to increase the minimum salary for teachers to $50,000 over the next 2 years, the largest increase in teacher salary in state history. The bill, which needs approval by the Senate, comes as GOP leaders remain split on a proposal from Governor Kim Reynolds to overhaul the structure and funding of area education agencies. Pregnancy bill sparks IVF debate. A bill to hike penalties for the non-consensual termination of a pregnancy sparked a debate on its effects on in vitro fertilization at the Capitol last week. The bill alters existing penalties and changes the term human pregnancy to unborn person, defined as from fertilization to live birth. Under the heading, they said, the decision of who should serve as president belongs to the voters. Not only would this disenfranchise Coloradans, but Iowans as well, who believe Donald Trump is the best candidate on the ballot. Frivolous attempts like this to harm the integrity of our elections should be struck down in similar fashion. Governor Kim Reynolds on Supreme Court ruling reinstating Trump on Colorado ballot. And this is the first time that in Iowa, when you work third shift or when you have small children and you don't have childcare in the evenings, you still got to have your voice heard. People still participated in this process. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart on the caucus results. Under the heading Odds and Ends, State Fair Acts. Rock band Greta Van Fleet and country singer Brett Young will join the lineup at the Iowa State Fair this year, the fair announced last week. The artists are the final additions to the fair's grandstand lineup. Tickets range from $35 to $60 for the shows, which will be held August 11th and 12th. School gun grants. Iowa House Republicans are advancing a bill that would create a $3 million grant program for schools to pay for guns and training for staff to carry guns at school. Lawmakers have a separate bill that would create a permitting process for staff to carry guns. Under the heading Water Cooler, Trump leads Biden. Former President Donald Trump held a commanding lead over President Joe Biden in Iowa in a potential 2024 matchup, according to a Des Moines Register MediaCom poll. The poll found Trump had 48% of support among Iowa voters, while Biden had 33%. Fentanyl penalty. House lawmakers passed a bill that would make someone eligible for a first-degree murder charge for selling or providing someone with fentanyl that leads to their death. The bill passed with bipartisan support, but some Democrats opposed it and said that it could bring severe punishment for someone who unknowingly shares a substance containing fentanyl. Turning to the Insight page, Gazette editorial fellow David Chung writes, in Iowa, our juries we prize, how we prize our liberties and maintain our rights. In Iowa, if you are registered to vote, have a driver's license or a state ID card, you are in the state's potential juror pool. I have observed that most people dread receiving a jury summons, but for me, as a history buff and political activist, I've always wanted to serve on a jury. On the other hand, because of my political activism, I never thought that I would actually be selected for jury duty. I was pleasantly surprised to find out that I was wrong. Like many Iowans, I have received multiple jury summons over the years. The summons comes in the form of a postcard with a number to call to see if you are required to report for jury selection. Most of the time, when I called the number, I got a recorded message thanking me and saying that my services would not be required. That changed a couple of years ago when I received a summons to report to the federal courthouse for jury selection in a federal criminal trial. The first step is to fill out a jury questionnaire. The questionnaire asks questions about potential jurors' backgrounds and experiences. I remember answering questions about my profession, whether I had ever been the victim of a crime, and whether I had any relatives or close friends in law enforcement. The next step, called voir dire, occurs in the courtroom. This is where the defense, prosecution, and judge question potential jurors. Some of the questions are for everyone, like how many of you own guns? Others may be related to answers from the jury questionnaire, like, on your form, you said you were the victim of a crime. How long ago did this occur? During voir dire, lawyers will often ask questions about the case's specifics. Both times I have participated in voir dire, the cases involved drug use, so jurors were questioned at length about their opinions on drug use. In one case, with an African-American defendant, the judge noted that the jury pool was all white and asked if we would be able to treat the defendant fairly. I raised my hand and pointed out to the judge that while I am of mixed race descent, I am not even a little bit white. Sometimes people use voir dire to try to avoid jury duty. In my case, I was afraid that my answers would cause the defense or the prosecution to request that I be excused. Jurors are under oath under voir dire, and I knew that I would tell the truth, even if it reduced my chances of being selected for the jury. The reason is that I believe in jury nullification. Jury nullification is the idea that juries have a right to judge both the facts and the law in determining whether a defendant is guilty. In other words, the facts may show that the defendant violated a law, but the jury may find the law itself unjust and declare the defendant not guilty. This goes against the instructions typically given to jurors by the judge in a criminal case. Judges traditionally give jurors a definition of the relevant law and instruct them that if the evidence proves that the defendant violated the law, the jury should return a guilty verdict. Jury nullification has a long history in our legal system. John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, said that juries have the right to determine the law as well as the fact in the controversy. Jury nullification has been used for both good and evil in our history. Critics point out that all white juries acquitted KKK members during the 1960s. Supporters point out that a century earlier, all white juries in the North refused to convict people who violated the Fugitive Slave Act and refused to return fugitive slaves to their white, quote, owners. Judges cannot tell juries what to decide, and once acquitted, defendants cannot be retried for the same offenses. I was surprised. Even though I stated my views on jury nullification, I was not excused and got to serve on a jury. I explained to the judge that I did not anticipate any issues in this case would be the cause for nullification. I was elected to be the jury foreman, and in that role, I worked to help the jury reach an agreement on the verdict. When deliberations began, I took a quick poll and found that a small majority was leaning toward acquittal. All the jurors took their roles very seriously. We reviewed the evidence presented in the trial, we watched some of the video evidence multiple times, and discussed what we had seen. Sometimes a juror's experience in a particular area helped to sway the group. In our justice system, a defendant is innocent until proven guilty. In a criminal case, the standard is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. After deliberating for half a day, the jury reached an agreement. The case was about a felon in possession of a handgun. The prosecution had failed to prove that the defendant met the legal definition of possession. The defense had produced a witness who claimed that the gun was his and they had left it in the car the defendant was driving. The witness was credible, and the prosecution failed to produce facts to the contrary. We found the defendant not guilty. While serving on a jury is a pain, it's time-consuming and interrupts work, school, family, and other commitments, it's essential to view this duty through the lens of the principles that define us. Iowa's state motto, "Our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain," describes what we Iowans hold dear. Serving on a jury is one of the practical means by which we uphold and maintain our liberties and rights. So when you receive a jury summons, don't view it as a task to avoid. Instead, view it as an opportunity to engage firsthand in the justice system by ensuring every individual gets a fair trial. And Gazette editorial fellow Chris Esperson writes, "Every effort to live in peace with everyone in Iowa?" Amber Gustafson regrets not having stood up and walked out of her church 10 years ago. She tearfully recounted how the pastor and elders got up in front of the entire congregation to shun a former member. They specifically mentioned her name. They said they went to her and told her to stop being a lesbian and that we were not to have any contact with her unless it is to get her to repent. The Ankeny mother of three recounts being stunned, having just finished singing a song about the glory and love of God. This occurred before her child came out to her, but she recalls thinking, "I don't understand a God that would punish someone for loving someone else too much." Amber and her family are one of thousands who will be immediately affected by Senate File 2095, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Iowa is in position to join 18 other states, mostly Southern, in passing the RFRA. This bill is awaiting Governor Kim Reynolds' signature and is expected to further erode civil rights in Iowa. Alexandra St. James Gray is an artist and creative from Des Moines. "I think this bill will impact the community. It will deny people access to a lot of things. Work, housing, access to financial services. It could affect all aspects of life." Gray is concerned about the lack of precise language in the bill. Its wording is very vague. It is left up to the individual who would be executing it. Indeed, for the most part, the bill is vague and cites the need to avoid government actions that are substantially burdening a person's free exercise of religion. What has not been sufficiently proven is the need for Iowa to have this law in addition to the federal RFRA. Iowa's law is ambiguous enough to justify critics' concern that it will likely result in discrimination against LGBTQ+ communities and communities of color. And it goes further in its clause that defines exercise of religion is acting in a manner by one sincerely held religious belief, whether or not the exercise is compulsory or central to a larger system of religious belief. Talk about a blank check. Gray worries about the way this bill could be applied to communities across Iowa. "We are repeating moments in history. The Bible says, 'Slaves, obey thy master.' This justifies slavery. We have a group of people who want to have a reason. They want to say it goes against my religion. This bill will affect all Iowans across the board." She stresses the urgency. "I wake up every morning and wonder who is on the chopping block. It is not a safe space." Gustafson struggles to understand how Iowa is passing bills that target her child and other families like theirs in the name of religion. For someone who has grown up in church, I don't understand how this squares. If it is about protecting their own integrity or salvation, once you give your life to Christ, you are sealed, giving medical care to trans people will not jeopardize your eternal salvation. Corey Jacobson, board president of CR Pride, talks about the unintended consequences the bill will have on Iowa's economy and population drain. It's going to come to economics soon. I recently had the opportunity to talk to graduating high school seniors. One student had a full-ride scholarship to University of Iowa and a partial scholarship to the University of Minnesota. I asked their plans, and they said, "I am going to Minnesota." They would rather take out student loans to feel safe. These are the choices our youth are making. Gustafson says we have real problems to tackle. My frustration is that Iowa has so many issues we need to deal with. The quality of our schools is falling. Public schools have to do more with less. Our nursing homes are falling apart. The legislative session is only 100 days, and there has been no bill to address mental health, the nursing home problems. If we have not yet passed a school budget bill, this is how they want to spend their time? Both Gustafson and Gray encourage Iowans to vote. Gray urges Iowans to pay close attention to the laws we are making and who is passing them. The bills are the same levels of discrimination and elimination tactics of Nazi Germany. We started censoring education and books. We started writing laws to isolate people. We have taken food away from children. Jacobson agrees about the need for better representation and cites the importance that community support brings. He also lauds what Cedar Rapids has done to become a welcoming community. I am really proud of the relationship with the city of Cedar Rapids and the CRPD and being able to provide safe spaces. The LGBTQIA+ community has not always had great relationships with police officers. Jacobson continues to have hope for Iowa. I want people to know that even though there is a lot happening in the legislature, that the people of Iowa are welcoming. There are pride festivals in small towns that you didn't see 5 years ago. These events continue to grow in size every year. There are also simple things he urges Iowans to do to mitigate these laws. The best thing is to get to know people, break those stereotypes, and come with a dialogue of respect. In daily life, I have to talk to people who don't agree with me, but I can have civil dialogue, and we can walk away with a positive interaction I hope they take with them into future interactions. I hope this can lead to little changes. He also encourages Iowans to list their business on the Affirming Business Registry or partner with CR Pride. And Gustafson has a plea to our lawmakers as we continue this legislative session. Please address issues that are actually impacting families. And turning to the community letters, and the syndicated cartoon, editorial cartoonist Joe Heller, based in Green Bay. We have some students and a teacher in the classroom. Teacher standing in front of the chalkboard with the 5 Olympic rings drawn it. And she asked the class, "Every 4 years, we gather our best people in a competition that unites our nation in pride. What is it?" A student raises his hand and says, "The presidential election?" And the teacher answers, "No, anyone else besides the class clown?" The first letter is from David Smalley of Anamosa. Small towns should watch large rail plans. Canadian National Railway has filed with the surface transportation regulators to purchase the Iowa Northern Railroad, which runs between Cedar Rapids and the Waterloo area. CN operates mainline tracks through Waterloo, so it would connect to the Iowa Northern there. CN currently operates a rail line into Cedar Rapids from Manchester, Iowa. If CN is successful in their purchase of Iowa Northern, I look for Canadian National to file to abandon their current line between Manchester and Cedar Rapids, since the line would be considered redundant. I don't know how much local business is along the Cedar Rapids and Manchester line, but Alburnett, Central City, Coggin, and Ryan should take note. David Smalley of Anamosa. Next, Niles Ross of Cedar Rapids writes, "Seniors should get the COVID vaccine." On February 28th, the CDC stated that people age 65 and over should get a COVID vaccine 4 months after the previous vaccine. The current vaccine is the same one as that offered in September and is formulated to target the current COVID variant. Senior citizens can get the vaccine now. Niles Ross of Cedar Rapids. Next, Linda Mustin of Iowa City writes, "Clark portrays Iowa in a positive light." Caitlin Clark's impact on young people has been well recorded and appropriately celebrated. But what about her impact on old people? At a time when octogenarians like us have been hand-wringing and head-scratching over the direction of the country, and especially the state of Iowa, it is wonderful to have a positive Iowa example receiving so much focus and adulation. We were there for the arena groundbreaking. We were at the old field house in 1980 when a victorious men's Final Four basketball team and champion wrestlers were welcomed home late at night. We were there for the women's basketball game when the 1993 arena attendance record was set at 22,157, much to the horror of the fire marshal. We were at the women's first Final Four experience in Atlanta in 1993. We loved being there last November among 55,646 at the crossover at Kinnick. We were there for the record-breaking games this year. So thank you, Caitlin Clark, on behalf of old people who appreciate your example for everyone, giving us reason to celebrate and for putting Iowa in the national spotlight in a most positive way. Linda Mustin of Iowa City. Karen Carlton of Waukon writes, legislation should be crafted by experts. If you needed auto repair, would you call a plumber? If you needed farming advice, would you contact a Harvard professor? Perhaps we have a broken leg. Would you call the local coffee shop owner for advice? Of course not. Then why does our governor rely on out-of-state political groups to craft Iowa legislation? How can some out-of-state organization propose Iowa legislation when the center of their proposals isn't what's best for Iowa citizens, but best for their own political agendas? Instead of simply accepting and voting for boilerplate legislation, shouldn't we expect our duly elected legislators to seek out advice from experts who know Iowa and its systems and needs? If the governor introduces legislation, shouldn't proper time be allowed for the legislature to read and study it? Without proper study, seeking out expert advice, and doing what's best for Iowa, the end result can be legislation that doesn't fit, has unintended consequences, worsens a problem, costs more, causes further damage, or tries to fix something that doesn't need fixing. Iowans know who to go to for auto repair, farming advice, and mending a broken leg. Heaping up the legislative plate with questionable content fills some people's desire to avoid dealing with Iowa's real problems. I vote to ban rubber stamps and misleading Iowans and vote to tackle some of Iowa's real problems. I'll raise a glass of Iowa water to that. Karen Carlton of Waukon. Next, John Kirkman of Cedar Rapids writes, why do we need a law to decide curriculum? As I am a member of the boomer generation, I remember American history, world history, civics, and government subjects being taught in school. What happened, and why do we need a law to enforce the teaching of those subjects? Did someone decide those subjects were unnecessary and should be dropped from the curriculum? I recall these subjects were required graduation credits. Do we really need a law to reinforce what is already being done? I am not opposed to the law, but I wonder if our legislature might spend its time while in session on more pressing issues. Somehow I can't imagine that happening. Our legislature has turned into a clown car packed full of clowns that can't legislate their way out of a three-ring circus. I remember being taught the importance of voting. John Kirkman of Cedar Rapids. Next, Betty Kohout of Lisbon writes, trust a felon to run the country? Our state House of Representatives, led by Republicans, must think Trump is guilty by the latest bill they are trying to get passed, House File 2610, changing absentee voting. For some people, this is the only means of voting. This all started with the last election, and someone to remain nameless at this time said it was rigged. Representative Bobby Kaufman is leading the pack. The legislation contains provisions allowing candidates for Congress and the presidency to appear on Iowa ballots even if they are convicted of a felony. Kaufman is a senior advisor for Trump's campaign in Iowa. Republican supporters of the bill hope it will head off any challenges to Trump's place on the Iowa ballot. Why would someone be able to hold a public office, especially the presidency, if they've been convicted of a felony? Some businesses want to do background checks to see if you've been convicted of a felony, and if so, you're not hired. Why would the presidency be any different? One would have a hard time trusting someone with a felony conviction to run our country. Betty Kohout of Lisbon. And quotes of the week, Governor Kim Reynolds on X, formerly Twitter, endorsing Donald Trump. She says, Joe Biden has been a disaster for our country, higher prices, inflation, an open border, crime, and the destruction of America's image on the world stage. I will do everything to defeat him and elect Donald J. Trump for president of the United States. Next, Wells Fargo spokesperson Mike Slusark, in a statement explaining the closure of the bank's downtown Cedar Rapids branch, the executive says, because we currently have bank branches so close to each other, we are consolidating them into fewer locations. Next, Representative Adam Zabner, Democrat, Iowa City, speaking in opposition to a bill providing $3 million in grants to schools for firearms and training for their staff. Representative Zabner says, the solution to school shootings cannot be state money to put more guns in schools. That is ridiculous. It is shameful. It's not a solution to the problem. Next, Linmar Superintendent Amy Kortemeyer, in a statement after District of Voters approved an extension of the physical plant and equipment levy, Superintendent Kortemeyer said, we would like to thank our residents for all of their engagement leading up to Election Day and the overwhelming support they provided to this important ballot measure. And Jill Weigel, reacting to her narrow victory in a three-way race for an at-large seat on Hiawatha City Council, said, "I'm very grateful that I have this opportunity and that people have had the confidence to vote for me." You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 10th, 2024, on the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service. I am your reader, Sharon Felgido, and today, March 10th, everything is an hour ahead. We sprang forward last night in the middle of the night. We turn to today's obituaries. From Monticello, Jan Byers, age 75, died Thursday, March 7th, and Getch Funeral Home in Monticello is handling arrangements. Dr. Ann Struthers of Cedar Rapids passed away peacefully on February 24th at age 93 with pen and paper by her bedside. A lifelong learner and teacher, she was a poet, writer, professor, Fulbright scholar, Malone fellow, 25-year faculty member of Coe College, and 60-year member of St. Paul's United Methodist Church. In 1997, she was awarded a Fulbright Fellowship and spent 2 years in Aleppo, Syria, teaching American literature at the University of Aleppo. Her chapbook, Aleppo Burning, illuminates her time in the Middle East before the Syrian Civil War. Subsequently, she was awarded a second Fulbright Fellowship in Colombo, Sri Lanka. Her chapbook of poetry, The Kindness of Crocodiles, explores the magic lives of animals of Sri Lanka. In recent months, she completed and was actively editing the memoir of her years in Syria with the working title, Anne of Aleppo. Carolyn L. Erickson, born Carolyn L. Zahn of Ladysmith, Wisconsin, passed away February 26th in Wausau, Wisconsin, at the age of 75. Carolyn worked as a dedicated first-grade teacher, primarily in Excellent in Bruce, Wisconsin, leaving a lasting impact on her students throughout her career. A service to honor Carolyn's life will be held Saturday, March 16th at Nathaniel Lutheran Church in Bruce, Wisconsin. Visitation will take place from noon to 1 p.m., with a service at 1 p.m. followed by a reception. She will be laid to rest at 4 p.m. at Riverside Cemetery in Ladysmith, Wisconsin. David Wayne McIntyre, age 68, of Marion, passed away February 24th at Mercy Hospital in Cedar Rapids. David worked in the construction and automotive industries all his life. A private family funeral for the family will be held, and a celebration of life will be held at a later date. Wesley Stephen Pohorski, age 83, of Keokuk, passed away peacefully on February 19th after an extended illness. Services were held in Keokuk with burial in rural Sandusky Cemetery overlooking the Mississippi. Wesley's arts and crafts reflected his love for the culture of the Southwest. In retirement, he spent countless hours in his studio overlooking the Mississippi River. His creativity was expressed in paintings, lariat rope art, unique gourd art, kachina dolls, and restoring Mexican saddles. Kenneth A. Schweitert, known as Kenny, age 70, passed away on March 7th in Sebring, Florida, with his wife Helen by his side following a long battle with lung cancer. Kenny loved to farm, and he continued until his retirement in 2015. There wasn't anything that Kenny didn't try to do. If it was broken, he would fix it. If it could be built, he would do it. Kenny loved to golf and was on the golf course many days after the Lone Pine Country Club was established. He was a league regular and often traveled with good friends for a day at a course in the area. Kenny was active in 4-H and FFA. He was a member of the Colesburg United Methodist Church. Services are pending at First Presbyterian Church in Lake Placid, Florida. Eleanor Stoy Cromwell went to be with the Lord January 4th at her home in Cedar Rapids. She was born in 1942. Always a champion for animals that need rescue, she asked memorials be donated to animal rescue groups. There will be no service at her request. She worked for Rockwell Collins and Alliant Energy. Helene Elizabeth Van D., age 92, peacefully departed from this world on January 7th after a short battle with pancreatic cancer. Services will be held 11 a.m. Friday, March 15th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service, beginning at 10 a.m. at the chapel. Helene worked at Farmstead Wilson's Foods for 25 years. In her retirement, she loved traveling with Vern, hitting the casinos, bird watching, and shopping with her daughters. Ellen Weber, affectionately known as the Queen of Orange, passed away peacefully at her home in Marion on March 7th at the age of 58. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 Friday, March 15th at St. Joseph Catholic Church, 1790 14th Street in Marion, with Father Sean Smith officiating the mass. Friends may greet family from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 14th at Ashton Hill Farm, 803 Vernon Valley Drive in Cedar Rapids. Gary Ray Greiner, age 77, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully on February 17th after a brief illness. To celebrate Gary's life, friends are welcome to gather on Saturday, March 30th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Blackstone Restaurant, 503 Westbury Drive in Iowa City. Gary had many skills, interests, and passions in life, including farming, construction, cooking, dancing, playing the guitar, singing, health, and travel. Curious about the world, Gary visited Italy, Spain, France, Iceland, Peru, Nicaragua, Mexico, the Philippines, and many places in the United States. He was in the U.S. Army National Guard. Nancy Ellen Stikeleather Thomas, age 91, beloved mother, wife, musician, and community volunteer, continued her journey in God's love on December 2, 2023. Celebration of Life, 1 p.m. Saturday, March 16th at United Methodist Church of Mount Vernon, with visitation 1 hour prior. Linda M. Logan, age 82, of Cedar Rapids, passed away at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital on December 2, 2023. A private family burial took place at Stockholm Lutheran Church near Cokato, Minnesota. A celebration of life will be held Wednesday, March 13th, at the Clark Alumni House on the Coe College campus from 3 to 6 p.m. A short service will begin at 5 p.m. Rita Beth Olson passed away on March 1st, 2024. She entered her heavenly home the way she lived her life, with courage, dignity, and grace. She passed away with Richard, her loving husband, holding her hand. Rita was a teacher for over 30 years in Illinois and Iowa before retiring from Madison Elementary School in 2005. Rita very much enjoyed being a resource teacher for special education students challenged with reading and learning disabilities. She was honored when one of her former elementary school students returned after graduating from college to thank her for inspiring her to become a special education teacher. This event made all the IEPs and other teaching challenges that she faced worth every minute of her teaching career. Rita inspired her family and many others with her devotion to Christ. She was a longtime member, lector, and Eucharistic minister at St. Pius X Church, served on the St. Pius School Board, and was chairperson of the Cedar Rapids Christian Women's Club. She was also a longtime member of Elmcrest Country Club and participated in book clubs for many years. Helen Delosier, known as Jeanette, age 95, of Iowa City, passed away peacefully, surrounded by her children, at Mercy Hospital on March 7th. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 11 a.m. Tuesday, March 12th, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church, with visitation held prior to the service from 10 to 11 a.m. Private burial will be at St. Joseph Cemetery. John A. Hart, age 89, of Cedar Rapids, passed away in his home on March 2nd. A private funeral mass was held at St. Matthew Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. After college, John began his career in Mansfield, Ohio, as Director of Junior Achievement. He later transferred to Cedar Rapids, where he opened and directed the local JA office. He subsequently held positions as account executive with WMT AM Radio, Director of the Kidney Foundation, and Director of the MS Society. Margaret Jean Walsh, age 90, of West Des Moines, died on March 1st. Funeral Mass, 10 a.m. Saturday, April 20th, at All Saints Catholic Church by Reverend John Flaherty. Burial, Calvary Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family after 9 a.m. before the service at the church. TN Funeral Home and Cremation is serving the family. Margaret served 2 years as a librarian with the Milwaukee Public Library System and spent the rest of her career with the San Francisco Public Library System. In 2017, she moved back to Iowa to be close to family members and celebrated many holiday dinners in their homes. Helen Louise Capecchi, age 91, of the Views of Marion, passed away Tuesday, March 5th. Friends may call at Cedar Memorial Funeral Home Thursday, March 14th from 5 to 7 p.m. A private family service will be held at a later date. Helen worked at the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School before moving to Cedar Rapids in 1952. She worked at Collins Radio for 31 years, retiring in December 1992. Helen enjoyed gardening, jigsaw puzzles, and spending time with her family. James John Burke, known as Jim, age 93, of Cedar Rapids, formerly a 58-year resident of Marion, passed away on March 5th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Memorial Mass will begin at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 23rd, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion. Family will greet friends 1 hour prior. Interment with full military honors at Calvary Cemetery in Ryan, Iowa, will begin at 2 p.m. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is serving the family. Jim served honorably in the United States Army 82nd Airborne Division as a paratrooper during the Korean conflict. He worked for the United States Department of Defense for over 30 years. Jim was a member of St. Joseph Catholic Church. He was an excellent baseball player and was drafted by the Chicago White Sox. Jim enjoyed camping, traveling, watching Westerns, and was a beer enthusiast. T. Terry R. Carden, age 85, of Winfield, passed away March 8th at the Sunrise Terrace Nursing and Rehabilitation Center in Winfield. A memorial service will be held at 4 p.m. Monday, March 11th at the Winfield First Presbyterian Church, where the family will receive friends from 2 until 4 p.m. Interment will be held at Winfield Scott Township Cemetery at a later date. Terry worked as a mechanic for Johnson Chevrolet right out of high school. He quickly learned that he wanted to be his own boss and spent the rest of his life farming on the family farm. He was a 73-year member of the Winfield First Presbyterian Church and also a member of Farm Bureau and the Columbus Junction American Legion. Terry raced stock cars in his youth and enjoyed tractor pulling and golfing. Later in life, his main hobby was fishing. Robert J. Hoika, known as Bob, age 82, of North Liberty, passed away January 20th at his home. Memorial gathering, 2 p.m. Saturday, March 16th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Bob served in the United States Army. He retired from Quaker Oats in 2021 after 45 years. Sherry Pipkin, born Sherry Olson, passed away March 5th, surrounded by her family. Services will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, March 11th, at Christ Church Presbyterian. Tien Funeral Home is caring for Sherry and her family. Sherry was a 60-year member of Christ Presbyterian Church, where she taught Vacation Bible School and Youth Sunday School for many years. She also invented Lolly the Clown, entertaining the kids and integrating happy times into her teachings. She and Larry were lifelong members of Merry Mates, where they made many friends. Alita Ray Abel of Kalispell, Montana, passed away at age 53 on March 1st. She returned to the workforce at Smith's Grocery in Columbia Falls as a checker and soon proved her value as an employee and became the customer service manager in the Kalispell store and then manager of their fuel center. She worked for Don K. Subaru, showing new owners how to navigate their technology, then spent a short time at Culligan Water before returning to Don K. and moving to join Three Rivers Bank as a new account specialist. A celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, at Buffalo Hill Funeral Home. Donald Digman, age 88, of Hopkinton, died March 6th at Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 o'clock Tuesday morning, March 12th, at St. Luke Catholic Church in Hopkinton, with interment in the Hopkinton Cemetery. Friends may call from 4 until 7 Monday at the church and again on Tuesday from 9 until 10. A vigil service will be held at 4 o'clock on Monday to start the visitation. Getch Funeral Home has taken Donald and his family into their care. Donald worked for the feed mill in Hopkinton grinding feed until he went into the Army. He served in the Army from 1958 until 1959, where he was stationed in Okinawa operating a milk rehydration plant. Don started farming with his brother Jack on his return from service. He was active off the farm as well. He played town team baseball until he was 30. He was an avid bowler even while in the Army, and he also enjoyed fishing and hunting deer and turkeys. Lois Jean Sheriff of Cedar Rapids, a celebration of life for Lois, 83, who passed away on February 25th, will be held at the Indian Creek Nature Center on Saturday, March 16th from 3 to 5 p.m. Paula Charlene Lapp, age 88, of Fouquet, Varina, North Carolina, formerly of Marion, passed away November 28, 2023. Funeral service 11 a.m. Saturday, March 16th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Interment, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation 9:30 to 11 a.m. Saturday, March 16th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Paula worked as an administrative assistant at the University of Missouri, Kansas from 1966 to 1990. After retiring, Paula and Thomas moved to North Carolina. She was a talented artist, creating many oil paintings. William A. Bergman of Keystone, Colorado, was born to Alphonse and Pauline Bergman nearly 100 years ago on March 15, 1924, passed away. Bill and his wife Jane became involved in the JCs and the Young Republicans, and Jane in the Junior League, PEO, Scouting, PTA, and the Linn County Board for Handicapped Children and Adults, as well as her charitable activities with their church. They also joined the Cedar Rapids Country Club, which became the hub of their family's recreational and social activities for many decades. Bill gained young entrepreneurial business clients, which helped him decide that his legal firm he would build would deal solely with those in private enterprise. In 1961, he partnered with Clint Moyer, a fine man 12 years Bill's senior, who practiced governmental law. Because of Clint's seniority and age, Bill insisted the firm's name be Moyer and Bergman. A celebration of life will take place in the summer at Keystone during golf season, date to be announced later this year. Ramon Leo Tracta, known as Ray of Spokane Valley,
born September 16, 1937, passed away February 28th. Ray was known for his strong-willed and intelligent disposition. His enduring legacy included unwavering commitments to his beliefs. He is a man who connected to nature and the great outdoors. Ray's life was defined by his love for hunting, camping, hiking, and many outdoor activities. Ray's passion for unspoiled wilderness extended to his travels to national parks with his family. He had a deep affection for dogs. A funeral mass will be held March 16th at noon at St. Mary's Catholic Church, 304 South Adams Road in Spokane Valley, Washington. Turning to the sports page, home away from home, Big Ten Women's Basketball Tournament semifinals, Hawkeyes reach fourth straight Big Ten championship game in fifth and sixth years by Jeff Linder in Minneapolis. They know their routine. They packed for 3 days. This is all we know, Caitlin Clark said. This is what we do. Did I need to say her last name? They play today at the Big Ten Women's Basketball Tournament. That's what they do. Clark registered 28 points and 15 assists, and number 3 Iowa ruled the paint in a 95-68 semifinal romp over Michigan before a vastly pro-Iowa sellout crowd of 18,746 Saturday afternoon at Target Center. The Hawkeyes, 28-4, set a tournament game record with 30 assists. We valued the ball, made some beautiful passes, shared the ball, Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said. It's so much fun when we're playing like that. Sydney Folter said, we moved the ball really well. Everybody was knocking down shots. It was fun. The Hawkeyes are in the title game for the fifth time in the last 6 seasons, the fourth year in a row in the Clark era. It's all they know. It's what they do. In my 6 years I've been here, I've gotten to the championship 5 times, so that's pretty cool, Kate Martin said. I'm pretty acquainted with championship Sundays now, and I really like them. Iowa seeks its third straight title today against Nebraska, 22-10, a 78-68 semifinal winner over Maryland. Tip-off is, okay, the paper says it's at 11 p.m. It is 11 a.m. I think by the time you listen to this, the game will already be happening. If you want to turn me off and turn the TV on, it's on your local CBS station. And Mike Kloss writes, Iowa seniors earn the thanks they'll get tonight. Cricky, McCaffrey, and Perkins have combined for more than 4,000 points in college. It's been said a dozen times in this space, and there's nothing unlucky about a 13th. Namely, the players are the best things about college athletics. It's not the coaches, fans, administrators, or the soft-serve ice cream on the arena concourses, and it's certainly not the pandering media mopes leading their lives of not quiet enough desperation. It's the athletes. Tonight is seniors' night for the Iowa men's basketball team. The Hawkeyes' 6 p.m. game with Illinois is their home finale. A win would put Iowa very much in the hunt for an NCAA tourney berth. 3 players with big roles in that may be making their Iowa City farewell tonight when the Hawkeyes take on a sturdy Illinois team. Ben Cricke, Patrick McCaffrey, and Tony Perkins are trying to help their team pull off what seemed highly unlikely not long ago, earning an at-large berth into the NCAAs. Cricke has spent just 1 season here, but I can't imagine a more seamless transition, said Iowa coach Fran McCaffrey. Cricke, perhaps the best basketball player to come from Alberta, transferred to Iowa after 4 years at Valparaiso, where he experienced 3 losing seasons and no postseason play. Yet he was first-team All-Missouri Conference last season on 11-21 club, which says a lot. So does scoring 2,000 points in a career. He averages 13.9 points for the Hawkeyes. He had 18 points and 14 rebounds in their win at Michigan State on February 20th. That was large. So was his 25 points in a win at Minnesota 9 days earlier. Patrick McCaffrey hasn't had a smooth 5 seasons at Iowa. He played in 2 games and then redshirted his first year for health reasons. He had anxiety issues and missed some time last season. This season, he was entrenched in the starting lineup until suffering an ankle injury in January that took a good month to heal. When he came back to play, it was a substitute. McCaffrey has 60 career starts, but embraced the role of a sub and has played some very good ball during his team's recent run of success. He contributed greatly to road wins against Michigan State and Northwestern. McCaffrey gets regarded as the coach's son first and a player second, but he has over 1,000 career points in a program that has won 85 games over the last 4 seasons. As a sophomore, he had 16 essential points in Iowa's 2022 Big Ten Tournament semifinal win over Indiana. 10 years ago this month, McCaffrey was a 14-year-old diagnosed with thyroid cancer. He had surgery to remove the tumor. He has had to be cognizant of a lot more things than the average athlete or person. He's had to eat and eat to keep his weight up and be strong enough to play Big Ten ball. Last season, he sat out a few games to deal with that anxiety issue. This season, the ankle problem. He's had some things to deal with, but he has really persevered, Fran McCaffrey said. Here he is, still playing and contributing in the highest level of college ball. Patrick McCaffrey said he's probably moving on instead of playing one more season of college ball. He can be proud of what he's done here. Perkins came to Iowa in 2020-21, the pandemic season. Imagine starting college in lockdown. Yuck. Then you do it as a freshman, finding your way in major college athletics, and you aren't playing much. The 6'4" guard from Indianapolis stayed for 4 years and has grown in each of them. He's been so much fun to watch when he's cooking, and he's cooked a lot. In Iowa's 4 wins at the 2022 Big Ten tourney, he averaged 10.3 points and 4.5 assists. That was enormous. Perkins riddled Illinois and Carver last year, scoring 32 points in Iowa's 81-79 win. This season, he leads the Hawkeyes in minutes, assists, free throws and steals, and is second in scoring and block shots. No Hawkeye had 15 assists in a game since 1989 until Perkins did it January 12th. He had 14 at Northwestern on March 2nd. Perkins, Cricky, and Patrick McCaffrey have earned their flowers. Good players, good people. And that last regular season game is going to be on 6:10 p.m. on Fox Sports 1, or you can live stream it on foxsports.com. That game is tonight at 6:10 p.m., and they are playing at Carver Hawkeye Arena in Iowa City. And because of the fact that I live in Coralville, I need to be cognizant of these things so that I don't get stuck in traffic on the way to Carver Hawkeye. And finally, for my reading today of the Gazette, The Time Machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. Two memorable moments. Terry Wilson jumped for joy, then had a pro golfer as a caddy. By Diane Vannon Langton, correspondent. Time Magazine published a striking photo of the Immaculate Conception basketball bench reacting to a basket during a February district tournament game at the Fieldhouse in Iowa City. The photo was part of a March 8, 1954 photo spread rounding up the week's best photos. Gazette photographer John McIver took the photo at the February 23, 1954 game between the Cedar Rapids Immaculate Conception Greyhound and the Williamsburg Raiders. The focus of the photo was Terry Wilson, a Greyhounds guard, who seems suspended in midair as he celebrates a basket by a teammate in the last quarter of the game. He is, in fact, about 3 feet in the air in the accompanying photograph, with striped socks, short white basketball shorts. He's holding something, a water bottle can of something, and his feet are splayed out. The game was a nail-biter. The Greyhounds had lost all five of their starting lineup to fouls or injuries by the fourth quarter. It was up to the reserves to pull off the win. The score was 56-54 with 16 seconds left. The subs managed the ball, and the Greyhounds won. The team's coach, Bob Jennings, had led the team to the Northeast Iowa Catholic League Championship that year, the Dubuque Diocese's Class A Championship over Cedar Rapids St. Patrick's, and the city's parochial title. The Class A District Final was February 27th in Iowa City and pitted the Greyhounds against the Marion Indians. It was the sixth time in 7 years the two teams had met. Marion beat the Greyhounds 54-49 to advance to Class A Substate Final March 13th opposite Grinnell. Meanwhile, McIver's photo of Wilson's leap placed first in the sports category of the Iowa Press Photographers Association contest in June. In 1955, when Wilson was a senior, the Immaculate Conception Greyhounds again took the city parochial and Northeast Iowa Catholic League titles. For the seventh time in 8 years, the team lost to Marion in the sectional tournament. Wilson also took up golf, which would have a greater impact on his life than basketball. After graduating from high school, Wilson enlisted in the Marines. In April 1958, while he was stationed in Hawaii, he entered the Navy Marine Invitational Golf Tournament in Honolulu. Japanese pro golfing star Torikichi Nakamura, or Torikachi Pete Nakamura, was on his way home after playing in the Masters Tournament in Augusta, Georgia, where he dropped a hole-in-one during practice. It turns out Wilson had caddied for Nakamura in two tournaments in Hawaii, the 1957 Pabst Blue Ribbon play at the Pali course and the 1958 Mid-Pacific Open at Lanikai. As a result, they struck up a great friendship, the Honolulu Advertiser reported. Nakamura found out Wilson was in the Navy Marine tourney. He asked Wilson how the first day went. Wilson said he'd carded a 78. "That's good," Nakamura replied, adding, "I will caddy for you." True to his word, Nakamura, a well-known golf pro, showed up to caddy for Wilson, a Marine from Cedar Rapids, for the tourney's second round. Nakamura, who won the Japanese Open in 1952, 1956, and 1958, knew what he was doing as a caddy, a job he'd held from age 14 until he turned pro at age 20. "Pete is not only the greatest putter in golf, but I'm certain he is the most humble, too," Wilson wrote in a letter to Alex Fiddler, the Gazette's street circulation manager he worked for as a kid. "I was quite shocked when he offered to caddy for me, as not often do you have a champion golfer caddy for you." Although Wilson didn't do that well in the tournament, he wrote Fiddler that he'd learned more in that one day about golf than most could learn in a lifetime. Nakamura, he said, had only one comment about Wilson's game. "He no understand English," the golf pro concluded about Wilson, meaning, "I was doing the exact opposite of what he told me to do. I'm sure it will prove the most memorable day of my life." After Wilson was discharged from the Marines, he returned to Cedar Rapids, where his name would often appear in the Gazette sports columns when he competed in golf tournaments. He retired in 1996 as a senior group corporate vice president for Archer Daniels Midland. He died in 2006 in Forsyth, Illinois, at age 68. Nakamura, who helped fuel the popularity of golf in Japan, died in 2008 at age 92. That brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 10th, 2024. I have been your reader, Sharon Falduto, selecting and lightly editing the articles that I have read to you for the last 55 minutes or so. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We do welcome your comments, and thank you for listening. I hope that you have a wonderful spring. Thank you. And I have been your reader, Sharon Falduto, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville.